Everyone needs a little help, even if you have trouble admitting it. You need sales help. It doesn't matter how long you've been in sales. The more you learn, the more you earn. If your sales need help, it's time to consider the Gittimer Learning Academy. It's the fun and easy way to brush up on sales fundamentals and learn new advanced strategies to close your next deal. We've got hundreds of hours of lessons on closing, referrals, prospecting. It's like Jeffrey sitting there right next to you, helping you close your next deal. You won't find a more comprehensive library of sales knowledge that you can actually use. Go to GittimerLearningAcademy.com and sign up for a free demo. Did I mention it's free? Free demo. I like free.
In the West, the buyer is king. But in Japan, the buyer is God. And God does not brook questions from mere mortals and riffraff salespeople.
Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sell or Die, the best, the coolest, the funnest, the most intellectually based podcast on sales and personal development in the universe. My name's Jeffrey Gittimer. I wrote The Little Red Book of Selling.
And I'm Jen Glecko, founder and author of Sales in a New York Minute. We are so glad you're here. What's up, everybody?
It's snowing.
Maybe.
Beginning to look a lot like Xmas. And our guest today is the great Greg Story. Now, you have to understand something. This is not going to be our usual kind of interview, American to American. He is American, but he is the president of Dale Carnegie Japan. And today we're going to talk about the major differences between Eastern and Western methods of sales and what we can learn or what you can learn from each other's culture. Dude.
Okay, so before we get into the interview, I want to talk about Dale Carnegie because Dale Carnegie has had such a profound impact on myself. I think you
and
as
me,
well.
Of course, yes.
And diehards, if you're not familiar with Dale
Carnegie, you better get out from under that rock.
Exactly. So, Jeffrey, give us a little background on Mr. Carnegie.
Dale Carnegie, born at the turn of the last century, wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People in 1937. The book is still in print. It's still an Amazon bestseller. And people from all over the world read thousands, hundreds of thousands of copies of it every year. The book has sold millions. It's iconic. He also wrote How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And I think it's most important to he has these 200 franchises around the country about how to have confidence, how to speak. He wrote the book on public speaking, Effective Public Speaking. And those three books belong in everyone's library. Don't go to the library to read them. Go buy them in the bookstore so you can use them for reference because it's a classic book to continue to go back to.
Don't buy some edited version by some or gal or whatever.
Yeah,
buy like the real version.
Go on eBay. Or ABE Books, and get an original.
Yeah. So back in the day, when
back in the day, we don't even play the music for back in the day because it was like 3 years ago.
It was over a decade ago.
All right.
We don't believe you on that.
Yeah, 11 years ago.
Yesterday.
Okay.
No, back in the day, I had this really bad experience giving a talk, and I'll go into that on another episode. It's not important for right now, but I wanted to never be in that position again, and I wanted to become a really great speaker. So I searched for presentation, courses, and came across the 3-day Dale Carnegie course, and it was life-changing for me. It's one of the reasons why and how I have become a speaker.
one of the cool parts about that course is that they video you giving talks, mm-hmm. and you give like 5 or 6 talks in 3 days. It's crazy. And maybe even more. And they video you giving talks, and then there's 2 instructors, and one of the instructors takes you in the back room right after your talk and gives you feedback on 2 things you can improve immediately for the next talk. And you watch yourself and you critique yourself, and it is so cool, and it's definitely something that even if you don't take the course, you should be doing for yourself in your presentations, in your sales calls, that kind of thing.
Filming yourself is hurtful because you have to see yourself.
Yeah.
I will tell you that you're the best sales coach and the best presentation coach you could ever have.
Mm-hmm.
Just watch the video.
It can be cringeworthy.
I would also tell you that I personally took the course in 1972, the Dale course.
Okay, that was back in the day.
Now you're talking back in the day. And it was so interesting. They made everyone shake hands with everyone. And a guy turned around and was sitting right in front of me. He was one of my best friends. And he was just taking the course coincidentally.
Oh, my goodness.
But a lot of people have taken that course. You can ask any CEO of any company. They've all read Think and Grow Rich. They've all read How to Win Friends and Influence People. And they've all taken a Dale Carnegie course, every single one of them.
And if they haven't, something's missing.
Yeah, they're missing a little bit of something right now.
That's right. And you know what's crazy? We're not even getting paid to promote them. This is just our honest review, okay? We should get paid.
I concur, Dale. If you're out there and you want to sponsor us, email sellordie@gittimer.com and we can arrange it.
All right, so it's time for a 5-star iTunes review. Nada, who do we got?
We have Halcom Bell.
Halcom Bell?
Yeah, again.
Is he a running back for the Steelers?
Maybe the Eagles, one you don't know. But Motivational Mondays are great.
Oh, this is what you're reading.
Yeah, exactly.
He's reading this 5-star review.
Halcom Bell writes,
yes.
Motivational Mondays are great. The guests and wide array of sales attitude and motivating topics are balanced well. Jen is great. I like Gittimer more when I didn't know that he was an Eagles fan. All kidding aside.
Very funny.
If you aren't listening to this, you're foolish and you do not manage your time very well.
Ooh, boom. I love it. Thank you, Halcom Bell.
Let's give him an Eagles boo.
All right, guys. You too can get your 5-star review right on our show. All you need to do is place it on iTunes.
And acknowledge that we're the greatest things on the planet.
Oh, my goodness.
Come on, in a humble kind of way.
Come on. All right, so we have a few announcements before we get to Greg's story.
We are nearing the end of 2018. Now, I know that comes as a surprise to many of you who don't know what month it is, but we have had so many amazing episodes this year, and we want to know your favorite. Vote for your favorite episode right now on our official Sell or Die Facebook group. You search Facebook for Sell or Diehards. Join the group. Vote for your favorites. Vote early. And if you're from Chicago, vote often.
And spoiler alert, we are going to take your favorites and put them together for a special end of year best of 2018.
That's not a spoiler alert. That's a banking alert. We're going to give you the best of the best, and your job is to listen, take action, and turn it into money.
That's right. Now,
all I'm saying is put me to work.
That's okay, right. Cool. So Nada is going to be taking all the best clips from those episodes. Now, it's time
for
our guest.
Yeah.
Let's get on to Greg Story, the president of Dale Carnegie Japan.
Ladies and gentlemen, and diehards of the world, today we have with us the great Dr. Greg Story. He is a 6th-generation Australian born in Brisbane, Queensland. How did I do for pronunciation in Brisbane?
Beautiful. Not Brisbane. Brisbane. Okay. Nice.
Oh, yeah, it's Brisbane.
His first job after high school was selling Encyclopedia Britannica door to door. Now, of course, that was in the 40s. Maybe I don't want to date him, but I don't want to date him anyway, but I don't want to predate his exposure to the real world because I was a door-to-door salesperson as well. He is the author of Japan Sales Mastery, Lessons from 30 Years in Japan, and the president of Training for the Dale Carnegie School in Japan. Diehards, please say hello to the great Dr. Greg Story.
Hello, Greg.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's really such an honor and a pleasure to be with you today.
Cool. We are glad you're here.
You can use my intro at your funeral. It was a pretty good one.
I'll get that transcribed.
So Jeffrey started talking about this at the beginning, but I want to know what it was like to sell Encyclopedia Britannica door to door.
I don't know about the American experience, but I just finished high school. I was 16. And then a few months later, I turned 17. So imagine 16-year-old kid turning up at your door in a sort of a lower income, industrial type of suburb, trying to get you to buy a very expensive set of encyclopedias for your kids and have to go through this this progression of learning the entire script, word perfect, 25 minutes, no questions involved, complete download, going through the Britannica example kit. Oh, I was hopeless. It was, it was so tough. And I realized, I'm hopeless in sales. I'm not good at this. I'll never be any good in sales. This is not for me. And, of course, I didn't sell much. I think I made one sale in the whole time. And I got out of it and did something else. So I stepped up in the world and became the guy who worked at the gas stand putting petrol in cars and then later trucks. So I moved up in the world.
That's an easy sale, you know.
Yeah, that was much easier.
Yeah, if they're out, they can't go anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. You buy or die.
So, Greg, I did exactly the same thing. In my last year of high school, I took a summer job selling Encyclopedia Britannicas door-to-door in industrial lower-class neighborhoods with a 25-minute pitch that I had to memorize.
Sounds very familiar.
It had all the foldouts. Did you have all the foldouts?
Yes.
And you carried around a briefcase?
Yeah.
The first question on my first night of cold calling was, did you get the bag open? In other words, were you able to convince somebody to listen to your story?
Yeah.
And I got the bag open twice in one night, which for this guy was like remarkable. Like you couldn't believe that I could get the bag open even once. And after my first week, I said, this is not going to be for me. Because everyone that I talked to had no money, or they appeared to have no money.
Exactly.
And I grew up in a family where they had money.
Yeah.
And I said to my boss, you're not taking me to the right neighborhoods. I got to go where wealthy people are so that they'll buy more. And they said, well, no, you don't understand. I go, okay, I don't understand, but we own a set of encyclopedias.
Well, I was just going to ask, did you actually own a set?
No, my family was in that same economic group too. We didn't afford encyclopedias. So,
you were trying to sell something you didn't even own.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah. But you could buy it.
By the way, my parents fell for it. They bought a set.
Of course. They live in a wealthy neighborhood.
They bought a set. But I think we had two sets. Oy.
But here's the deal with that. It was a push sale.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it did not involve the buyer whatsoever other than to get affirmations along the way that they understood or that they saw the benefit of it or that their kids wanted to do better in school. And it was, they played on the, if Billy doesn't get this, he's going to be an emotional and intellectual buffoon. And poor little Billy sitting there.
Not wanting to be a buffoon.
And the dog barking, and I'm trying to lay books out on the floor. And, Greg, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
So I do exactly what you're talking
Greg,
about.
Greg, I want to go back to you. So now in your journey, you're selling, or maybe I should say serving, gasoline to cars. Then what?
And you went to premium gas, of course.
I wound up working in an office environment, an insurance company. Then I became a laborer. I was what we call a brickies laborer in Australia, laying bricks. Oh, I wasn't laying. I was supplying the bricks in the mud for the bricklayers. And then building. I was a buildings laborer. I worked in a factory. I worked in an abattoir. I worked in a shipyard. I worked on the railways. Worked laying big mainline pipes for water supply to cities. And then at the age of 21, I went to university. And then I got into academic life, and I loved it, and I was going to become a professor. I was in Modern Asian Studies in Brisbane in Australia, which was a new faculty back in those days, and I was going to become a professor of international relations and political science. But somewhere along the line towards the end, I'd done a bachelor's degree, I'd come up to Japan, I'd done a master's degree here, I'd done come back to Australia, back up to Japan, do my fieldwork for my PhD, already become a professor. And my phone was ringing all the time because it was the late 80s. The bubble was on in Japan. A lot of people said, look, I want to buy from Japan or I want to sell to Japan. Can you help me? Because I knew Japan. And I said, okay. So I started my own company. I started my own consulting company. And I quickly discovered that being a student in Japan and being a business person savvy about Japan weren't the same thing. And it was going okay, but I realized, well, there's a lot of stuff I don't know. So eventually I got headhunted by a company called Jones Lang LaSalle, which was called Jones Lang Wooten in those days, and I joined them figuring I'd learn a lot, and I did. I learned a lot with them about business. And then eventually I came back to Japan in 92 to open a brand new trade office in Nagoya. Did that for 4 years. Then I went to Osaka and took over the operation there for 4 years. Back to Tokyo, ran the Japan operation. And then I joined a Japanese bank, the Shinsei Bank, and a retail bank for selling wealth products to wealthy people. And got headhunted to run the National Australia Bank as a country head. And then I bought the Dale Carnegie franchise here in Japan. And then I joined the business. So that's a very potted history of Greg's story.
I'm Jeremy Fulkerson, and I host the Hidden Stories podcast on the Sell or Die Network. In our podcast, we share stories of seemingly everyday people that are your neighbors, community leaders, entrepreneurs, survivors, mothers, fathers, and friends, but we don't share the regular dinner talk conversations. I believe we all want to be better spouses, friends, parents, and leaders. My hope is by hearing these hidden stories, it will give you the courage to be a better you. Find me on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. There are links in the show notes to subscribe.
Okay, so what are some of the biggest things you had to do to adjust to business life in Japan? You mentioned being a student there and being a business person there were totally different. What are some of the adjustments you had to make?
I think probably, you know, I'd come back to Japan. I got there in 79, and then I lived there for about 6 years on and off, and then I came back after about a seven-year break in 92. And so I'd been boning up on, you know, Zig Ziglar and Brian Tracy and Tom Hopkins and all these guys, consultative selling. So right back in Japan, and I'd been making business trips to Japan in the 3 years I was with Jones Lang LaSalle, but now I was on the ground. And I'm trying my consultative selling techniques, asking questions, unlike Britannica, where he's giving a pitch. But stony, I don't know whether this is like in New York for you, Jeffrey, but stony silence. I would ask a question, they would just look at me. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I'd just repeat the question. They'd just look at me and wouldn't answer. And then they'd basically say in Japanese, well, give me a pitch. And this just went on and on. And I thought, geez, this is hopeless. You know, I mean, if I can't ask questions, how would I on earth know how I can serve these people? So it took me a while to work out that there was something wrong here. And the problem was it's a religious problem. I know you're very religious, Jeffrey. It's a religious problem.
I'm a devout coward.
Yeah, it's a religious problem because in the West, the buyer is king. But in Japan, the buyer is God. And God does not brook questions from mere mortals and riffraff salespeople. So it took me a while to work out. I had to actually get them to give me permission to ask questions first. Hmm. And so I worked that out, and that turned things around. I could start asking questions and finding out what they wanted. But the other problem in Japan is they talk about, not cowards, but they're very conservative. They're very, very risk averse. Mm-hmm. This country has no upside for innovation individually, risk-taking, taking on the new, but a big downside. Hence, everyone looks to protect against the downside, and they don't really care about the upside that much. So trying to get them to do something new, which would be to take a Jeffrey Gittimore course, buy Jeffrey Gittimore's book, come to Jeffrey Gittimore's program, or our program, whatever, very, very hesitant about doing something new. And that's even though we've been here since 1963, Dale Carnegie's been in Japan since 1963, doesn't matter. We've been going for 107 years around the world. Doesn't matter. We don't care about that. This is Japan. So this is the thing. They're very risk averse. That's what I found. I still find very, very hard to do. And I've sort of got around the questioning problem now, but that risk aversion is a tough one.
How do you figure out what's going to be different? Like, a lot of our diehards are doing business in different countries, and we don't always know the nuances. How did you learn them?
Yeah, I think part of it is exposure to Japan, of course. That's very important. Knowing the language, in my case, is a big help. So I can read the body language. I can read the subtle signals. I can pick up on the wording. Like, there's a great Japanese set phrase here. So, Jeffrey, you're making a call on the Japanese buyer. And at the end of your presentation, they say, Jeffrey, terrific. We're going to positively look at your offer, which in Japanese means no, we're not interested. So it's knowing these little hints that actually that means no. The first time I got that, I was so excited. Oh, great. They're going to look at my proposal in a forward-looking positive manner. This is terrific.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
And then someone wise, you know, say, hey, stupid, that means no. Oh, right? So it's knowing those sorts of things. And also, I think, again, as a foreigner, you have some advantages, though, because you're a bit, particularly speaking Japanese, even if you don't speak Japanese, you're a bit unique, you're different. That in itself gives a little bit of interest to get you in the door. It doesn't get you the sale, but at least it gets you in the door. And I think understanding that risk aversion is very important. If you understand that, then you prepare yourself. And also know it's not going to be one call. It's mm-hmm. going to be lots of calls.
I think one of the interesting things here is the evidence that the more you know about the buyer's culture,
yes,
the easier it's going to be for you to at least make some kind of communication. And we've all heard the same idiom here in America where you have to speak the customer's language. But in your case, you literally had to speak the customer's language. And I think that gave you a modicum of respect. Like, here's this guy, he doesn't look like us, but he can speak our language pretty well. And maybe we should listen.
And it's sure not an easy language to learn.
No.
It is not. And we're all still working on it. One good thing about Japan, though, is it's an honest culture here. If I'm not exaggerating, if you dropped your wallet on the street, someone would put it somewhere where you could easily find. Maybe there's a little shelf, little something there on the road. They just put it there. They don't steal it. They hand it into the police. You get a call. We've got your wallet. Come and get it. Very honest. So in business, I mean, okay, there are evil people. There are bad people all around the world. I know that. Never, every Japanese is perfectly honest. But proportionately, compared to anywhere else, it's a very honest culture. So you get paid here. You know, we've been running our franchise. We bought the franchise 10 years ago. Running our franchise for 10 years, never had a bad debt, never, ever had a problem getting paid.
Wow.
People are honest. And so one good thing about that is we have rule of law here and you get paid. And so they may not buy your product, they may not go for your offer, but if they do, you know you're going to get paid. So there's some pluses here, you know. And they're also the great saying here, and I think you both know this English saying, the devil you know, and the other part of it is better than the angel you don't know. Jeffrey, Jen, and myself, we're all angels. We can help you. But as
two
far
out
as
of
can
three, speak, I'm going to say two out of three, but go ahead.
Yeah, so you're not.
They're going to go for the devil. They're going to go for their existing supplier, the existing relationship, and you're the newbie, you're the new entrant. They're not going to go for that very easily. So this is where, when you're out on the outside, that's a pain. But when you're on the inside, it's not a pain. It's beautiful because they keep coming back. They keep coming back. We, like, for example, last year, we had a 43% repeater rate of clients who'd bought from us in the previous year and a 15% repeater rate for people who bought with us for 3 years in a row. That's wow. Pretty good numbers, you know,
yeah.
as a farming sort of metric.
So I think that the issue you're describing is not that unique to Japan in that a lot of us who are in sales, a lot of our diehards deal with that very same issue. They're already dealing with a current supplier and now, you know, someone else is trying to come in and how do they get in? And so what are some of the techniques you use to get in and make the sale?
Well, I follow Jeffrey's books and teaching and
smart move.
Ask the right questions, you know, intelligently designed questions to uncover need. Mm-hmm. The example I often use is about pink and blue. You know, say, for example, Jen, say your favorite color was pink. Let's say it's pink. And I come in, I start talking about my range of blue. I can blather on about blue till the cows come home, but you want to hear about pink. So
For the record, it's red, but...
Well, we'll go for red. We'll take it red. Doesn't matter. I talk about blue, Uranus, and red. The point, though, is Japanese salespeople don't ask questions because it's God. They just give their pitch. So they're pitching blue. The buyer wants red. I think my advantage is when I come in, or anyone who's properly trained comes in and starts saying, what color do you like, Jen? Oh, you like red. Let me explain to you the value of our red. Let me give you how this is going to help you in your business. So the fundamentals of sales are not being applied here by salespeople because they're fundamentally untrained. So how do you get in? Ask questions, provide value, make sure that you're lining up your solution with what they need. All the basics, but the majority of people here in sales are not doing that.
And also, let's keep in mind, he does speak their language,
mm-hmm.
and it's a foreign language to us, and he's probably learned by now to ask permission to ask a question.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's sound of... the niceties of mm-hmm. sales. He knows the manners and the culture, and that endears him in a way that other people would not be endeared. I think, Greg, that you have – obviously you've mastered this process by mastering the language and the content that goes with the other things that you sell, but still in the final analysis, you wouldn't be getting anywhere if you didn't know their culture and ask the right questions.
That's true. And also patience. You know, you have to have a lot of patience. Now, I mean, we see these numbers, you know, 7 contacts with a client before you get a deal in our own cultures. And that's probably, I don't know exactly what the exact number is, but I see these things written down. That's probably about right. But here, the decision-making process is a group decision. So, you know, at the end of a call and they say, well, we've got to think about it, right?
Right.
And then if you go into a lot of these different sales techniques, well, here's my 50 ways of dealing with that pushback, you know, and some of them are very aggressive in American style, would never work here because they're a group-oriented society and they're a collective. And so there are lots of stakeholders inside the company who will be impacted by that decision, and they will need to get all of those stakeholders to agree, get a consensus before they invite in the angel they don't know to be the supplier. So they really do have to harmonize within the company and make a decision. But no matter how much you try your snazzy, pushy technique on, well, when do you have to make that decision? Forget that, impossible. They do have to make a decision internally. Once you know that, you have a different job. Your job now becomes to arm your champion or the interlocutor you're with, the person you're with, to give them the value and the evidence to convince their colleagues.
Gotcha.
That's the difference.
So one person is your message carrier inside the company?
Yes.
You have to have an ombudsman.
Yeah, well, they're rarely the decision maker, unless it's a owner, president, one-man show, you know, the powerful president makes all the decisions. The person you're talking with rarely would be a sole decision maker, almost never.
So your sale is not only dependent on how good you are, but how good they are.
Exactly. And your job or my job is to make them brilliant. That's the point. But if you know that, then you're ready for it. If you don't know that, then you're trying to do some pushy sales technique that's not going to work here.
Pushy sales techniques don't really work anywhere anymore.
Yeah.
Not with the internet. I think people are over them.
Even car sales.
Yeah.
The pushy is pretty much gone. I don't know about mobile homes, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think they're gone.
Anything that involves you riding in something that appears to be a house is trouble before you even start. But I think that there's enough good salespeople right now to where the numbers are starting to work towards the good.
Well, there's not enough of them here. I mean, you have the benefit in America of people like yourself who are doing very, very good training and writing books on the subject, really a lot of material to draw on here there. But Japan, the salespeople are getting what they call on-the-job training, OJT. So you're getting the sort of dregs, really, of instruction on selling from a bunch of extremely mediocre bosses. So they haven't got the same caliber of professionalism that you're getting in the West, I think. So they're trading off the brand name of their company. Oh, I work for XYZ company. That's enough, you know, as opposed to them personally having professional sales ability. So we've still got a long way to go here. And that's why we do sales training. And when we look at the people coming to our classes, the level is pretty abysmal, I got to tell you. It's bad.
Really?
Oh, it's bad. It's bad.
And how quickly can you get them up to speed?
Well, you know, if you can imagine, they're visiting Jen and they start talking about red. That would be probably a good start, you know, knowing that red's the color. So you just teach them that one thing, to actually get on the wavelength of what the customer's interested in, and then know how to, you know, present the solution in a way that tic-tacs with what the client's looking for. Well, you're bound to do a lot better because you're going to, like, I'll give an example. This is very typical. Guy comes in to see me. He wants to sell me on a particular booth in a trade show for HR. So we often deal with a lot of HR people in the training business. The guy is, he's probably late 50s, I'd say, Jeffrey, feel late 50s. So he's been doing this, you know, for a good 30 plus years, right? 35 years plus. 50-minute pitch. Not one question. Now, I'm watching the guy. I teach sales training. I'm thinking to myself, well, this will be interesting. I wonder when this guy is going to actually ask me a question about my business. 50 minutes. Goes through the whole, you know, catalog, and here's your booth size, and here's your position, and blah, 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 and you can give this talk, and da-di-da-di-da. No questions. And another guy came in. He had it was a software product, came in, younger guy, late 40s. He was a director of sales. Opens up the oyster shell of the laptop, 60 slides, not one question. Hmm. At the end of it, I said, could you go back to slide 34? There were two slides in that whole presentation which were relevant to me. He could have saved 23 minutes, you know, of just blabbering on about his whole 60-slide deck. We could have gone straight to those two slides, and he probably would have done a deal. This is what's missing. You know, they're not asking questions. They're not doing the basics. So wasting time and wasting effort.
Why did you sit there for the whole boring presentation? I'm just curious from the potential buyer perspective. Like, if not interested, I would just say, like, yeah, no thanks, and not waste like 60 slides worth of time.
No, I'm a bit like
Are
Jeffrey.
Are you saying
Jeffrey,
I'm not polite?
You're talking about the Electrolux vacuum cleaner salespeople.
Yeah.
Rainbow salespeople, right, on Monday Morning Motivation.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. I want to see the guy's pitch. I have to respect salespeople. You know, I think we're a great profession. I think that, you know, you got to give people a chance. And I'm also fascinated to see these Japanese salespeople and see how they handle themselves. So I'm also, you know, I'm a sales trainer. So I'm wondering to myself, well, how's he going to get to the pitch part here about the questions? Not the pitch part. How's he going to get to the questioning part? How's he going to ask me a question?
So it was like research for you.
In a way, yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, I give him a chance. You know, I give him a chance and maybe I might fight. Now, as it turned out, with the guy who was in the HR show, I bought anyway because I thought, well, I'll give this a shot, see how it works, you know, to test it. So he made a sale, but it was nothing to do with what he was doing. You know, so
in spite of himself, he made a sale.
In spite of himself, yeah. He,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he got the software guy. I mean, this is, I'll give you another example. I'm sitting next to a guy at a British chamber function, Japanese guy in his late 30s, and sales guy to sales guy. You know, I said, you know, Mr. Tanaka, when you get an objection like, you know, your price is too high, what do you say to your customers? He said, oh, I just dropped the price by 20%. I just about fell off my chair. I said, you dropped your price by 20%. I said, why do you do that? And why do you do that? Because that's how he's taught. He doesn't know how to handle objections. He doesn't know how to question an objection.
Wow.
He doesn't know how to find out what's the real reason. Get under the waterline of the iceberg here. What's the real problem? doesn't know any of that. He just drops it by 20%.
Well, I'm going to start telling all Japanese people I do business with that their price is too high.
Yeah.
See what happens now.
Yeah, see, they'll drop their price by 20% straight away. All right.
Oh, man. Well, this has been totally insightful.
I love the part about taking the metaphor of speaking the other person's language literally, because Greg has to do that in order to just get in the door.
Mm-hmm.
So he has already pre-prepared himself to communicate in terms of the other person impressively. I'm sure there are people that their doors are blown off by the fact that you speak their language.
Yeah, well, it's a bit disarming for them because they will be thinking I'm going to be speaking in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do it in sales calls, but I do a lot of public speaking as well, and I do a lot of public speaking in Japanese. And so I learned that a very nice thing to do when you've got to do a talk in Japanese is start in English.
Yeah.
And I'll start with, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much today. And they're all going, oh, my God. It's going to be English.
Yeah.
I hate speaking in English. I didn't study English hard enough at school. Oh, what do I do? And then I break into Japanese. Oh, thank God for that, you know. So it's a bit of leading them up the garden path a bit. But it's a bit like the tightrope walker who almost falls off, you know, at the theater, the circus. You see, they slip and you go, oh. It's a bit like that. I sort of learned that works quite well when I'm speaking in public in Japanese as a speaker. But I don't do that in sales calls. But no, they are visibly relieved when I break into Japanese. But you don't have to speak Japanese to sell to Japanese people. A lot of them speak English. I mean, I don't want anyone in America hearing this or around the world to think, well, if you don't speak Japanese, you can't sell to Japanese people. Not true. You can, but you just have to know what you're doing. So, you know, that's one reason why I wrote the book. But there are ways and means of doing this which are best practice and more successful than others.
So, Greg,
I've perused the book, so I'm no expert at it, but I can tell you that it will be in our show notes.
Yes. Tell us where people can buy the book.
Amazon is probably the best shop.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
You've shown my books, but you haven't shown yours.
Ah,
oh, don't worry. I happen to have one right here.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Very good.
Up here it says bestseller, Amazon bestseller. There you go.
There you go.
Which is totally, totally unexpected for me. I never even had it in my mind, a bestseller. But, I mean, you know, I didn't go and buy millions of books so I could make it a New York bestseller like everybody else.
I understand. So we want to thank you for coming all the way from Tokyo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thousands and thousands of miles on the internet. It takes 2 nanoseconds instead of 1 nanosecond. And we totally appreciate your the opportunity to gain the insight of speaking the other person's language.
The idea of subtle clues in sales meetings.
What do you take as a subtle clue?
Well, there are so many.
Yeah, like get the hell out of here. What part of get the hell out of here do you not understand?
So, okay, I pay very specific attention, and die hard, you should too, to nonverbal cues. I think they tell a lot more than actual verbal cues. And for example, you know, how someone is leaning in when they're talking to you, if they're looking at you and paying attention, if they're on their phone, you know, those kinds of things. But then I also love to look around someone's office and see what kinds of things they have on their desk, they have on their wall, what is important enough for them to bring into their place of work to display.
Well, here's the challenge, diehards. In order for you to discover the subtle clues, you have to be listening. In other words, you can't be going through your boring as hell slide presentation and hope to gain a subtle clue.
So that was like a yes and.
That would be a yes and. Yes, and if you...
I love it. So okay. If you guys missed the Tuesday episode, go back and listen to Gina Tremarco's episode where she talked about yes and. It was so freaking good. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yes, and one other thing, Jen...
Yes, Jeffrey.
If you are observant enough to see something that stands out in the person's office, you want to ask them, how did you get this? Where did this come from? So that you can engage them in an emotional dialogue, because there isn't one award that somebody has that they don't feel some emotional attachment to, or they wouldn't have it on display. I'm going to give you an example. A friend of mine here in Charlotte, his name is Jeff Epstein, was a used furniture guy, but before he was in the used furniture business, he was in the Secret Service.
Ooh.
And he guarded the President of the United States, the Reagans, the Bushes. And I looked on his wall, and there are three or four photos, but there was one photo that was on a separate wall, and it was of George H.W. Bush. And so I asked him, what's special about this one? And he said, well, I kind of saved his life.
Like, you don't kind of save someone's life. You either save it or they're dead.
Exactly. But Bush had written on there, thank you very much.
Oh, my God.
For your service.
That's freaking cool.
Totally cool.
But you were observant enough to notice that he specifically put it on a wall by itself.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about when I say look around their room.
He actually complimented me on singling out that one picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he singled it out. So you were getting in his mind,
yeah.
Okay? And then the thing—
It was pride for him. That was his proud moment.
Exactly.
There.
And that takes the sale. Like all, you know, we get a lot of questions in our Seller Die Hard official Facebook group. When people join, they write the number one sales challenge they have. And a lot of people lately have been saying that they're looking for other ways, new ways to build rapport and new ways to build value. And, you know— If you want to build a relationship with someone, talk to them about what they're displaying.
Yeah. Get their specific.
Get
their subtleties,
because mm-hmm.
there's tons of them around their space.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So get out there and do something for us. This is the season to give, and we want to receive.
Amazing transition right there.
Reminder to go. Well, it'll be memorable for us. Go to Facebook. Vote for your favorite episode. And join our sales street team.
Yeah, so we have a street team that is going to help promote the book. We have a few requirements of things you got to do. And you sign an agreement. Once you sign that agreement, we will send you free copies of the book signed.
That's a sales manifesto. And
sales in a New York Minute.
Okay.
And you will get those books in exchange for doing, you know, a couple of things for us, including actually buying the book. But that's in the agreement.
Yeah, we give you two books for the price of one. Don't
or
we?
Two books for the price of two.
No.
Oh,
yeah.
We get two books for the price of two.
Yeah. You just go in the Facebook group. You can search for Street Team, and that post will pop up, and you can download the PDF, send it off to us, and once we receive signed, we ship out your books.
Cool. Now, our Sell or Die podcast network is growing. We have added Selling with Soul. It's a podcast with Meredith Messenger, who is cool as hell, and Jake and Gino.
Yes.
Who have the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast about real estate, has also joined the network. And these guys are funny as hell, and they're really on the money. They're about how to build a real estate portfolio and earn a bunch of money to become what they have done, which is financially independent.
Every time I see Meredith Messenger's podcast name,
yeah,
in my head, I want to sing the Billy Joel song, It's All About Soul.
Well, there you go, Jen. I think you could lip sync that in front
of 1,000
people. I have
totally proven to every diehard out there that I cannot sing, but yeah. I will do it anyway.
And so until next time, I am Jeffrey Gittimer.
And I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm reminding you, ho, 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 get out there and sell something even if your ass falls off.
Oh, yeah.
Sell or Die Hards. Love the show? Make sure you've subscribed.
And if you've subscribed, make sure you rate us on iTunes or give us a star on Overcast.
And if you've done all of that, tell a friend about the best sales podcast on the planet. Or better yet, tell both your friends.
And if you've done all of that, well, you're a true sell or diehard, and we thank you.